Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
The Cinema Specialists are back, and today we are talking about Jojo Rabbit and the Great Dictator. Kind of strange. Some of you might be wondering, why did we do this? And I'm going to turn that over to John, because I'm going to be honest with you, I already forget what our reasoning is. So, John, what movie made us do this?
Oh, it's the new Guy Ritchie film, of course. The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, which is an alt history World War II movie a la Inglourious Basterds type movie, but we can't talk about Inglourious Basterds because we already did that.
And so we decided, let's do some other alt history kind of movies. And what we landed on was The Great Dictator and Jojo Rabbit. And I feel like this perfectly kind of encapsulates again what we're trying to do with this series. And you know, it seems like people are starting to discover the series a little bit more. Last week we did 28 Days Later in Sunshine, our highest viewed of the series. That's exciting. Everybody shake your hands out. If you're watching, please make sure to like and subscribe. Do all of that fun stuff. We did the two Godzillas off the bat, and then we followed it up with, what was our second episode, John?
It's John Wick and Hard Boiled.
Oh, yes, which was very fun to talk about last week, Sunshine and 28 Days Later. And now this week with Jojo Rabbit and the Great Dictator. Jojo Rabbit 2019, this is a movie nominated for Best Picture. Parasite ends up beating it. But Jojo Rabbit was in it, man. Like, Jojo Rabbit was in the cultural zeitgeist coming into COVID. And then the Great Dictator is probably one of the lesser seen of Charlie Chaplin's classics. It seems like City Lights, Modern Times, Gold Rush, maybe even like The Kid, which I know is only like an hour long. But this is one of his lesser seen classics. And so I'm excited to talk about both of these. Obviously, the way that Guy Ritchie's movie is doing it is very much more of the Inglourious Basterds approach of like, look at us, look how edgy and badass and all that fun stuff. And, you know, whatever you want to do. These are definitely more in the realm of reality, at least to an extent. Obviously, if you're making a Charlie Chaplin movie, it's going to be a little bit more slapstick. It's going to be a little bit more comedy. Like, you're going to have to expect that. But I'm really excited to talk about both of these. I think this will be a fun discussion. And if you haven't seen either of them, make sure you see them both. If you haven't seen The Great Dictator, if you've seen Jojo Rabbit, but you haven't seen The Great Dictator, listen up, because John and I are going to be talking about it now. And yeah, so John, what's your main takeaway from was it your first time viewing The Great Dictator? And I know that this was multiple viewings for Jojo Rabbit. So how are you feeling about both of these movies?
This is the first time I've revisited Jojo Rabbit since its theatrical release in 2019.
Me as well.
Holds up. honestly, I had a very good impression of the film afterwards, and it's good to see that it really holds up 5 years later. And this is my first time watching The Great Dictator. And like you said, it's one of those Charlie Chaplin movies that, because it's not the silent era Chaplin, people kind of overlook it a lot. It gets mentioned a lot as like a movie you should see. But when you're looking at Chaplin's filmography, it's one that you don't usually get to until you explore the rest of it. And there's a lot of comparables between these two films, I think. And obviously, the humor in Jojo Rabbit is more dialogue and script-based, whereas the humor in The Great Dictator is very slapstick, as you would expect from Charlie Chaplin. But what both of these movies do really well is using humor to lighten the mood, but not overshadow the dramatic tones of either film.
Yeah, these movies both do a great job. I mean, so both of these movies have Adolf Hitler. Mm-hmm. Right off the bat, if you have Adolf Hitler in a movie and you're saying, we're going to be a comedy, you're saying, okay, let's see how this is going to go. Because, I mean, Adolf Hitler and comedy are not two things that you think of alongside each other. That's just for sure. But the way that they both handle this and the way that they both poke fun at the situation and poke fun at Adolf Hitler, and especially with The Great Dictator, 5 years before Hitler kills himself. 5 years. Think about how much wasn't known when The Great Dictator came out about everything that was going on. And Charlie Chaplin, you know, he was very much like so committed to making it known and speaking up against this at a time where there were movies that were speaking out against Hitler and against Germany and things that were going on there. But I feel like this is probably one of the first iterations of just straight on the nose to the point. This is it. And both movies are very, very dark, but they're also very funny. And I think that's what it is. And I mean, we'll get to the speech at the end of The Great Dictator. If you haven't seen The Great Dictator, you've probably heard at least parts of the final speech, because the final speech is one of the most iconic speeches in the history of film. Paolo Nutini, for anybody who listens to Paolo Nutini, has a song where he samples most of this speech into the background of the song. So you can check that out. I think it's called Iron Sky. Let me make sure on that one. But I like Jojo Rabbit more. Like in my estimation, The Great Dictator doesn't quite live up to the hype of the other Charlie Chaplin movies.
Yeah.
But as soon as this ended, I almost gave it 4 stars anyway, just because the final speech is so incredible. So, I mean, look, we're going to be talking about the comedy in these. We're going to be talking about the historical significance of these movies. We're going to be talking about their use of Adolf Hitler, the way they are able to make comedy out of such a dark and horrible situation. And I think we're also going to be talking about just how good these movies are. So, John, what do you think we should start with? Should we start with The Great Dictator? You want to do that?
Yeah, sure. That sounds good. Because I think The Great Dictator is the one that's going to have the hardest pull for a lot of people. And yes, obviously, this is the big movie that like is the lesser known of these two at this point. Mm-hmm. Where Jojo Rabbit was, as you said, majorly successful when it came out 5 years ago. The Great Dictator is 84 years old now. 84 years old now. And that, you had mentioned already, that's what it really sinks in when I was watching this movie. Watching it progress, seeing the depiction that Chaplin decides to do, not only for the dictator, but also for the Jewish people within the film. This movie came out in 1940. And if you think about that, World War II probably just started when production on this movie began.
Yeah.
Right? World War II starts September 1st, 1939, officially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because what? Hitler comes to power in 33. But the war doesn't start for 6 years after that. I think that's
right. It's the invasion of Poland and everything that officially declares it. But that's just really goes to show how in tune Chaplin was with what was going on as the person who wrote it and the person who starred and directed the film. Chaplin knew what he was doing when he made this movie. And he was very aware of the situation that was going on. And what's very interesting about this, the majority of the slapstick in this movie happens peripherally to any of the horrors of World War II. And that was very interesting for me. You start the movie starts in World War I, and the opening sequence of this film, I couldn't stop laughing. It was so funny. Mm-hmm. It's egregiously over-the-top slapstick, exactly what you'd expect out of a Charlie Chaplin movie. And it sets up everything for the rest of the film, which you don't normally suspect in a Chaplin movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like a prologue, right? You're not used to seeing this kind of prologue in a Chaplin movie where he is setting the tone of Hinkle is fighting in the war. And actually what's funny about it is you don't know whether it's Hinkle or it's Hitler. Because so what was so very
Hinkle, interesting. Hinkle is the dictator. The barber is unnamed.
Oh, sorry. So you don't know, yes, because they don't call him Hitler in the movie. They call him Hinkle.
No, he's Hinkle.
You don't know if it's Hinkle or if it's the barber. That's what's kind of funny. And then, like, later on you find out. But I don't know if you caught the joke in the credits where it said any resemblance between Hinkle and the barber is completely coincidental. Like, that is just phenomenal. And I love that. But you're not expecting this type of prologue, this buildup of this is what this movie is going to be about, or like this character in the war. It's very slapsticky. And again, you were talking about how this is a talking Chaplin movie, which it wasn't the first of his talking movies, but it was an early talking Chaplin movie. And so he was still doing a lot of the silent movie shticks throughout his movies, which is fascinating. I always appreciate that. So it's a really funny opening, and then you do go right kind of into Hinkle, and you're still kind of a little unsure which way it's going. What did you think of how the movie balanced the two stories? Because this is the prologue, so you're introduced to the barber, but then it's a little while before we actually get back to the barber.
Yeah, and of course we have that moment where they're like, oh yeah, the barber was kind of in a coma and now has amnesia, doesn't really remember anything. Not really a major story or plot point until it gets reminded to him later on in the film. But without that little overlay there, I don't know if we would know if Hinkle was the barber or not. And that's kind of where I thought the direction of this film was going. I thought that this was going to be one of those, oh, the barber looks like Hinkle, so it's the people confuse him for Hinkle and everything. That doesn't happen until the last 15 minutes of this movie, which I was surprised beyond belief that that was the direction it took.
I hadn't seen this movie since college, so it's been 10 years plus for me. And I totally thought that that's what the premise was, you know, a Jewish barber is mistaken for essentially Adolf Hitler. I know that they keep, they call him Hinkle in this, but that's what he's mistaken for. And so I was like, oh, that's a fun concept. And then I forgot as I'm watching, I'm like, oh, that doesn't happen. Like, really the only reason. So this is what I find interesting about these, about the two storylines in this movie, is the only reason both storylines exist simultaneously is so that the last scene can happen. That's it. That's really the only reason both storylines are happening. Yes, it's showing the horrors inside the ghetto. Yes, it's showing one of the most brilliant scenes ever, and we'll talk about it, but with the world bouncing it on his butt and doing all of that, I mean, it's just absurd. But we could talk about that, but it's to me, the weakness of the movie is that it doesn't get to this point sooner. But then also, you cannot have this speech be anything other than the end of the movie. It has to be in the beginning slash, you know, or I'm sorry, it has to be at the very end of the movie. If it's in the beginning slash middle of this movie, it doesn't work. And I would almost, like, we talked about It's a Wonderful Life on this podcast a while ago. If you haven't listened to that, go listen to our top 100 movies and listen to that one. But we talk about in that podcast how it, nowadays, if they made that movie, he would be seeing his life flash before his eyes in the first 10 minutes. Like, that would be the inciting incident. It wouldn't be the final act. And I feel like if this movie was made today, that's what would happen.
Yeah.
This movie 100% would get to the point of Hinkle and the Jewish barber going head, you know, or being confused for each other. And it honestly would probably go the approach of Hinkle seeing what it's like in the ghettos and the Jewish barber seeing what it's like to get the power. And then it would be, okay, how are those two things going to be balanced? And what are they going to learn as characters? I don't know if that's necessarily better, but I do think that there is something to be gained from having this happen a little bit earlier than just the last 10 minutes of the movie.
I think it's a different movie if you do that. And I think that's the more important thing with this is if you're having that switch and you're having, you know, Hinkle learn what it's like in the ghetto and stuff, I think it's a different movie, and I think it sends a different message here. Because the big, one of the most important things about the way this movie ends, Hinkle's never redeemed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because you're not redeeming Adolf Hitler.
No, you can't.
You can't. Like, it's not, and this isn't before the extent of his, like, heinous war crimes became apparent to everyone. You still couldn't redeem him for the way he was going about things in Nazi Germany. And the film, there is a point at the end of the film where I'm like, okay, where's the actual Hinkle? But it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. And that's what I think is so fascinating about the way that Chaplin decided to make this film, is rather than having a character learn everything, the character who's learning everything is our amnesiac barber.
Yes.
So we still have that audience surrogate to understand and learn about the ghetto through. But we're also seeing him from a different standpoint, and he's really embodying this idea of the person needed to stand up against these bullies and this enemy in order, just because, like, he refuses to paint on his window.
Yeah.
Because not only that,
he erases the paint from the window. That's the exactly. big thing there, right?
It's just this film, for when it was made, is really progressive. And obviously, like, there's a propaganda aspect of it when it comes to this time period and everything like that. But I feel like the message in this film, and then there are little moments that really punctuate it. Like, the message of the film is by far the end speech, right? This idea of like humanity coming together.
I'm gonna read from that speech. So go ahead, finish up your point, and then I am gonna read from that speech. So.
Okay, well, it's the idea of people coming together, working together. And throughout the film, we see a lot of people talking about doing that, but not willing to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, the fascinating thing about it. That is what really makes it so entertaining. And again, it's what makes both of the films we're talking about today entertaining, is the fact that they balance the comedy with such serious and heavy topics. Even though the topics aren't exactly the same in both of these movies, they're similar enough that you can see how they're connected.
Yeah. So I'm going to butcher it. So these are the first, I'm going to read the first three paragraphs because I feel like this is before it starts getting into the soldiers and everything like that. But I think these first three paragraphs are what this movie is trying to say. And even if the movie doesn't get it across, there's, like, you can say there's propaganda and, like, you know, anti-war and all that. But the thing is, this is what this movie is. So I'm just going to read this verbatim. This is the quote from The Great Dictator from the speech at the end. So for anybody who hasn't seen it or, you know, is just listening here, it's worth just hearing this part. And it is the Jewish barber has just been mistaken. So the Jewish barber gets arrested and put into a camp. Yep. And then him and another German, another Nazi soldier, essentially, they escape from the camp hidden and disguised as Nazis. So now the barber gets mistaken and Hinkle is out hunting ducks in regular clothes. And he is now mistaken as the Jewish barber who had escaped. So we have the Jewish barber mistaken for Hinkle and he gets up to go give a speech. And they think he's going to give a rally cry for war. And instead it's this. I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone, if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there is room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent and all will be lost. The airplane and radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. That's only half of the speech. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's an absolutely unbelievable, incredible piece of writing. Yeah. It is so of the time. Unfortunately, he wrote this. It was out in 1940. It wasn't able to stop the war from continuing for another 5 years. But this is where Charlie Chaplin was at. Yeah. And, you know, you had said, you know, a couple minutes ago, for the time this movie was progressive, for now this movie would be progressive. Mm-hmm. People look for any reason to hate each other right now. It does not matter. Everybody is looking for a reason to despise each other. And it is whether it's a thought, whether it's an opinion, whether it is a religion, whether it is your skin color, your sexual identity, people are looking for a reason to hate each other. This speech could be given today and would resonate, I think, just as powerfully. So what do you get from my rendition of being the Jewish barber?
I think one of the big things with this is, as much as this is a plea to humanity, this is Chaplin pleading to humanity, it also feels like a very personal soliloquy here. It feels like it's very personal to Chaplin. And I think it really explains a lot of why Chaplin does what he does, just as an entertainer, right? That idea of uniting people through happiness that he speaks of in the speech. This is a man, like, this is a man who has witnessed two world wars at this point, who has seen the world at a point where it looks like it is going to tear itself apart twice. And you have to ask why. Like, and he has the power and the notoriety and the fame to present a plea like this. And the other thing to remember, 1940. What year did the United States enter World War II?
I have no idea. Was it 41?
It was 41 after the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. 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 Cause it was, right? Well, so pretty much 42, because what, that's December 7th, 41. December 7th, so pretty much 42. Yeah.
But like, this is because the United States had the non-interventionalist approach there and the isolationist approach that they wanted to take going into this war because they didn't want to be devastated by it. This coming from an American making an American film, it's huge to see this, mm-hmm. and to see this type of passion behind trying to unite people in a time when people are getting more and more divided.
Yeah. 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 And like, it's hard to really talk about the rest of the movie because, I mean, like, when you talk about Jojo Rabbit, mm-hmm. Jojo Rabbit does do such a better job of balancing all aspects. Whereas this movie really is like looking at, oh, look, the Jewish barber is friends with this guy because he saved him during World War I. And so that guy then makes it so that they have it a little bit easier in the ghetto and all of that. And then you have, like, again, I think the best scene of the movie other than the speech is when Hinkle realizes and picks up the world and starts bouncing it in the air. And he pretty much does a ballet with the world. Mm-hmm. Hitler had that much power, people. Like, he really did. He literally had that much power. It's insane. I love those scenes, but it's like the speech is what makes this movie, what sets it apart, what ultimately earns it that iconic status and makes it something that should be viewed by people. And honestly, like, you're not going to regret watching The Great Dictator. There's good slapstick. There's good verbal humor. And it has a very, very, very powerful message. Also, like, some of the visual humor is great. I mean,
so funny.
Dude, the fact that they have the branding on the garbage cans, It's just like, what in the world? It's so next level. What were you going to say? Because you jumped in.
Because the Venus of today and the Thinker of tomorrow.
Oh, it's so
sculptures
good.
Are so funny because it's the Venus de Milo and the Thinker doing the salute. And it's so funny. I couldn't. Again, like, this is the beginning. This is right after Hingle gives his first speech, which is in German. And, you know, watching movies, anytime foreign language comes up, you start thinking, am I supposed to have subtitles on right now? But you're not, because we get the English translation afterwards. And the, again, such a simple form of comedy that's kind of overshadows how terrifying this speech is. But just by simplifying, like, Hinkle goes on, and the translations are so short in comparison.
Mm-hmm.
With
that scene, I love the moment where he's doing the, they have the guy coming on, and then at the end of it, it says this was predetermined that he was allowed to say this, whatever. But like, he's giving the speech, saying things like sauerkraut. He's saying things like he's just making, you can tell he's just making up words. He's not actually speaking German. And then though, at one point you hear him get really, really angry, and it goes on for like a minute and a half. And the guy who's narrating it just goes, Hinkle just referred to the Jewish people. And that's all he says. And you're like, yep, of course he did. It's just, it's brilliant. Like, it's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. And again, like, and this is right after, this is the first thing we see after this entire opening, like, prologue sequence, which I have to say, the plane sequence in this prologue is so funny.
It is.
So simple. It is. So funny. Just this idea of like the plane flying upside down and the pocket watch falling out and then the water falling out. It's simple. It's so simple. And we've kind of gotten to a point where slapstick comedy is very passé. It doesn't really exist anymore. That being said, like Hundreds of Beavers, great slapstick comedy. Talk about it a lot. Go and watch it. But this movie, again, balances it really well, because after this moment, there's not as much slapstick in there. We have a few moments. We have the one where Hinkle and Napoloni, who's the
Mussolini counterpoint. Mussolini, yeah.
And the barber shop scene, hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
When they're just like pumping the barber chairs up higher and higher to be higher than the other one. It's so funny. It's simple comedy. It's simple visual comedy that tells you everything you need to know about these two men.
Yeah. And earlier I said that this was early in Chaplin's sound films. This was his first sound film, because he refused to make sound films. So this was his first sound film. And so for him to have his first sound film end with that speech, it was kind of like he had fought so hard against making talking movies because he thought it kind of destroyed the medium. And you see throughout the movie that he wants to keep doing his modern times humor. I mean, Modern Times came out almost 10 years after sound, and it's entirely silent. I mean, it's pretty incredible. And so when you watch this movie, you can see his tendencies. You're talking about the barber chair and all of that. He wants to stay slapstick. He wants to stay silent type humor. But if they were going to make him talk, man, he was going to say something. And you know what? Yeah. Like, when you have an opportunity to use your voice, I think there's a time and a place for everything. You know, when you win an Oscar, you don't have to go up and tell me all of your political beliefs. Like, I get it. But I feel like, you know, in this era, in this time, in this world, when it really was this bad, I love it. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you make a good point, right? He wants to keep his silent era stuff so much so that the barber is essentially the tramp.
Mm-hmm.
Still dresses the same, still walks the same. Like, it is the tramp, but it's a different character completely here. And we mentioned it earlier how this movie, you feel like because Hinkle and the barber are played by Charlie Chaplin, it'll be like a swapping places type story.
Mm-hmm.
The real restraint in this movie comes from the fact that nobody mentions it.
Nobody.
At all. Yep. That the barber looks like Hinkle.
Nope. And you know what's funny about that, though, is Chaplin was doing the tramp little mustache thing long before Hitler was around.
Yep.
that's kind of the interesting part of this, right? Is like Chaplin was doing the Hitler look before Hitler existed. Hitler made it iconic, but when you go look at Charlie Chaplin, it was 1920, he's doing this look.
Yeah.
So that actually is kind of like a little inside baseball kind of humor there of, you know, nobody's telling Hitler he looks like Charlie Chaplin.
No.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's wrap up The Great Dictator. What else you got? Anything else?
I think the biggest thing, again, and I'm going to bring it back to this point where he's washing the word Jew off the window. Mm-hmm. And the big thing that spoke to me there is this little act of defiance encouraging others.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we see, is that the entire ghetto kind of rallies around the barber in this movie. And it's partially brought on by his ignorance of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
But his ignorance also allowed him to have the strength to oppose his oppressors. It's a very interesting take on everything. And it feels like Chaplin's trying to say something to the American populace with this moment.
Mm-hmm. What do you think he's trying to say, John?
It feels like a plea. It feels like a plea of, hey, somebody needs to stand up to them so that they know they can start fighting for themselves.
It's the little acts of defiance that ultimately lead to significant change, right? I mean, that's really been it throughout history. Mm-hmm. I'll end it with this one. This is the last paragraph of the speech. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed and hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite. That's a great dictator. Go watch it. It's worth good it. Film. If you haven't seen very it, watch film. It. If you have, let us know what you think. 30-minute mark, perfect timing. Like the video, subscribe to the channel. Thank you. For those of you who are listening this far in, we greatly appreciate it. We're about to talk Jojo Rabbit. Jojo Rabbit. That's where we're at. John, I had also not seen this movie since it came out in theaters. And I remember loving it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember convincing myself that it was very good, but not great.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, yeah, it's a good movie. Like, I'm sure people like it, and kind of just forgot all about it.
Mm-hmm.
The first time watching this movie now, the first time they show her shoes, I said, oh, fuck me. I was like, this is it. Yeah. Dude. And I know I try not to curse too much on this podcast. I really do. But that is I said it out loud. My wife and I were watching, and she goes, what? And I was like, do you not remember the shoes? And she was like, no. And I was like,
well, you will.
God. And that is so Taika Waititi has not made a movie of the Jojo Rabbit caliber since Jojo Rabbit.
Jojo Rabbit.
I was going to say he has What We Do in the Shadows. What We Do in the Shadows is very much just a mockumentary. It's very funny, but it doesn't have this. This movie is so artistically sound. It is so beautiful. The performances are great. The comedic elements to this movie are fantastic, but it's the moment with the shoes and how the shoes keep coming up. It is when Thomasin McKenzie, who plays, what's the girl's name in The Wall?
Elsa?
Elsa. When she plays Elsa, when she hears about Nathan's letter and how she reacts to that. There are so many great, beautiful moments. The slow motion at the end, pretty much pulling from Saving Private Ryan. For anybody who hasn't seen Saving Private Ryan in a very long time, it's pulling from Saving Private Ryan of people but it's kids screaming. It's not adults screaming. It's children screaming at the top of their lungs. It's a beautiful movie, man. This is a 4-star, no questions asked. I should watch this a lot more often than I do. I am so impressed. I really am. I remembered liking it, like I said, but I am so impressed.
I think what Taika Waititi really does well here is he immediately sets up this juxtaposition between the comedy in the film and the atrocities of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
He leans in so hard and so egregiously to this idea of children wanting to be Nazis and going off to like weekend camp to learn how to use weapons and everything. And as an audience, you're watching and you're like, this is hilarious. This is ridiculous. And you have that moment where you're like, this actually happened.
Yep.
And that's the power of this film, is it never, like, yes, okay, there's the ridiculous, like, head Hitler in JoJo's head and everything, right? But, and I mean, I guess some of the characters are a little far-fetched, but, like, I guess mostly, like, Rebel Wilson's character is a bit far-fetched. But other than that, it walks that fine line between absurdity and realism so closely.
And okay, so, you know, when you watch a movie like this, you realize, and I don't want to act like I'm placing my political views into anything, because I'm not, but you realize how, whether it was 1930 something or it's 2024, any political party that wants to rise to power, the children and the youth are the way to rise to power.
Mm-hmm.
Because we see it in this movie so well. Jojo Rabbit does not know better.
Yeah.
But he, and there's a line in this from Scarlett Johansson where she says to him, you're not a Nazi. You're just somebody who wants to belong to a club and feel important.
Yeah.
It is so devastating because you have her as a mother where if you push against this too hard, it might make him lean even harder into it. But you know that what he's doing is awful. You're trying to prevent it with every inch of power you can. But there's nothing that you can really do. You're in a lose-lose, because if you tell him stop being a Nazi, he's going to go and report on you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be the end of you. Or at least it's going to put you on their radar, which you can't afford because you are hiding a Jewish woman in your upstairs attic.
Yeah.
It is so complicated. But I don't know if there's a movie out there that does a better job of showing the atrocities on the youth. And when we were talking about The Great Dictator, my two favorite anti-war scenes probably in the history of film, the end of The Deer Hunter kind of stands on its own. They're seeing God Bless America. But it's the speech in The Great Dictator, and it's the Tomorrow Belongs to Me in Cabaret.
Mm-hmm.
Jojo Rabbit doesn't have one single scene that matches the level of either of those, but it has like a million smaller scenes that come so damn close that they almost add up to the equivalent of that. Because there is so much despicableness in this movie, but it's behind the eyes of a child, which one, makes it a little bit easier to swallow, and two, also makes it a shit ton more disturbing. So yeah, I've spoken too much. Go ahead, John.
I think like the big thing with the decision to have this child as the main focus of this movie, and again, it shows the absurdity of it, the entire situation. People are very defensive of children. And what we have here is this child so far indoctrinated that he, you know, has an imaginary friend, Hitler, who tells him, just go do it. And he grabs a grenade and, like, blows himself up.
Mm-hmm.
That is the start of this movie. Yeah. And because of that, we then get this very touching and moving and dramatic film filled with comedy where we see Jojo learn. And that's the premise of this movie, is not that, you know, this kid is a Nazi, he doesn't know any better. It's this kid is still young enough, he can learn when things don't make sense. And simply having that, like, when he meets Elsa, of course, like, he's making his book and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But as he converses with her more and starts speaking with her more, it becomes more and more apparent to him that she's not different than him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of this movie, is it takes its time for him to come to that realization. And it's not just like, oh, the war's over, now you're fully on board. It's, I'm already questioning things as we get to the end of this conflict.
Yeah, he starts, what's the first time he starts questioning things, right? It's when she takes the knife and everything like that. What would you say the moment that he starts to question everything is?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I'm going to look it up. I'm going to look up the story so that I can remember the exact order things happened.
No, it's just when he meets Elsa, I think, is when he like starts questioning about it because and I think it's really subtle. I think there's subtlety in it, and it's because of the responses that we get from Sam Rockwell's character in this movie. And Sam Rockwell's character, not talked enough about it in this movie. To be fair, I get it. We have this brilliant performance from a child actor. Thomas McKenzie's also fantastic. And Scarlett Johansson, of course, is phenomenal and in this film.
Taika Waititi is unbelievable in this movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is his best role. Like, he's so good.
But Sam Rockwell is so good because the way his character answers Jojo's questions about Jewish people it's just spot on, because it's never he doesn't go the propaganda route, right? Where you have, in contrast, you have Rebel Wilson's character, who does say, oh, what, my cousin was hypnotized by a Jew.
Hypnotized to the point of, and then he does all this crazy shit. Like, if you listen to that speech, I can't remember exactly what it is, so I'm not going to.
Oh, and he cheated on my sister and stuff like that.
And like killed somebody and like ran something over, and it was because of a Jew. Like, it's so ridiculous. But I think the turning point for him when he starts to realize is when she starts giving him the answers from the book. It's the first it's the Nathan letter. That's really what the first turning point is. He reads her the first Nathan letter, and she gets so upset, she goes into the wall. And then he goes and he writes a second Nathan letter. And the second Nathan letter is what shows, okay, the humanity is starting to break through. And again, what's another thing that political parties, you know, since long before Hitler, unfortunately, but it keeps going now. What they will do is they will say, that person is scary, don't talk to them. You could never get along with such a person. And, you know, to simplify it the easiest, extreme Democrats, extreme Republicans, they feel the need that they can't talk to somebody on the other side of the political line. Really, it's not that true, because you probably wouldn't even know the difference unless you're talking to some guy, you know, who's like an absolute jerk off, speaking. However, you're really not going to know in most cases, because most people are having normal conversations about normal life things. And then you're going to start to get the humanity. Once you remove the humanity from somebody, that's when it becomes easy to hate. And you see this at the Hitler youth camp at the beginning. They're calling the Jews it. They're talking about it. Oh, it's going to attack me. And then they're training the kids to kill bunnies. Because if you can kill an innocent little bunny, and you think that, the Jewish race, air quotes, as they're calling it, you think that that is going to be, you know, something that you can just wipe out. Like they're creatures. They have horns. Like, if you can kill a bunny, that's going to be no problem for you. And that's the really sick part of this. And at the beginning of the movie, it is really uncomfortable. Yeah. But as soon as they hand him the bunny, you say, okay, I get where this movie is going. I know where this movie is going. And Taika Waititi playing Hitler, the way he is able to balance it, it could be so bad, but he makes Hitler look like an absolute buffoon. And that's the important part. And I mean, that first interaction that Jojo has with Elsa, when he leaves and Taika Waititi's in there holding his heart like, oh my God, that was terrifying. How did we survive this? It makes him look like such a buffoon. And when Jojo eventually kicks him out the window and he goes flying, it's so damn satisfying. But this movie just has so many moments, and it really shows that the atrocities of when people don't feel that other people are worthy of being considered people. It's just disgusting.
And it has the counterpoint, obviously, with when Jojo's first talking to Elsa, I think it's like the second time they're talking. And he asks for an explanation of like who the Jewish people are. And Elsa's response is, we're like you, but human.
Yes.
and it's such a powerful, powerful line, because obviously the Nazi propaganda is telling them the complete opposite. Everything we've seen in the film so far has told Jojo the complete opposite, but it's that reflection of who are the real monsters in the situation. And again, like one line, five words, super powerful.
Yeah, there's a reason why Waititi won best screenplay for this movie. Yep. You know, I know that was a good year, great year for movies and everything, there's a reason he was able to win best screenplay. And it's because of lines like that. A lot of movies will try to over explain something or whatever. That is such a powerful line. Were you but human? And you see JoJo throughout as he's starting. I mean, one of my favorite shots of the movie is when he is in the robot suit hugging whatever his friend's name is. And then at the end of the movie, the two of them reunite again, and they're not in the robot suits, and they hug.
Yeah.
Because they become human again. They really have. And to go back to The Great Dictator, which we were talking about earlier, there's a part in there where it says, do not let the machine men with their machine minds take your machine, like whatever. Machine men, machine minds. That's what it was with this. And that's just a really powerful little shot right there that just, you know, shows the humanity of these children as they're coming through.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of shots in this film and just cinematography in general, Taika Waititi does such a good job at putting these little tiny differences in the film. The first time we see Elsa in the film, that entire sequence is shot like a horror movie.
Oh, yeah. Dude, with her hand coming around the wall.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It is beautifully done. And you as an audience member who is aware of history knows where it's going. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you're like, okay, what's the reaction then? How's that going to go? And I don't think you could really ever see this movie unfolding the way it does. And then, I mean, let's talk about the shot of all shots in this movie. Those shoes.
Mm-hmm.
That shot where you don't see anything else with Scarlett Johansson in that shot, just the legs dangling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we talked 2019, very good year for film. Is this the most powerful shot of all of 2019?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say that or the lights flickering at the end of Parasite. It's one of those two shots. But no, I mean, the other one, Waves, also came out that year. And my God, the scene of eating the hot dogs in the hospital haunts me until the day I die. Just that shot of the hopelessness. Yeah. And that's his life now. Sorry. But the way it's set up is what sets this apart from other shots. It's the fact that we see her shoes three other times at the exact same eye level. She's walking on the wall above him. She's standing on whatever above him. You see it numerous times. And then for him to be following the blue butterfly.
Yeah.
And then he looks up and before he even sees it, we see it. And it's just the shoes right next to his head. I have chills, dude. Like, yeah. I have chills. It is so unbelievably powerful because at that point, it is now for JoJo, it's been taken from you. You thought that Hitler and the Nazis were on your side and they killed your mother. Because she was helping this girl who you've now built a friendship with. And from there on, obviously, I mean, at that point, he's already so anti everything. He's already kind of, you know, realized the wrongs of all of his beliefs. But that moment is just absolutely devastating. It's so hard not to get emotional and cry when you see that. And he just keeps clinging to it. At that point, with no care that he is clinging to the feet of a woman who was hanged for hiding Jews, which could get him killed. They didn't care that he was a child. They'd kill him.
Yeah. It's so powerful. And again, that's the balance that Waititi finds in this film. It's also the moment when, like, the SS shows up. And, I mean, that's what, Stephen Merchant, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I love Stephen Merchant. What a great actor.
Yes, he is. But he comes in and they do the Heil Hitler and everything. And Elsa comes down and pretends to be his sister. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, there's so much tension in that scene. And that's what this film does well. It's like, yes, it's a comedy, but there's tension. There's so much tension. And then they ask for the papers. And Sam Rockwell's character takes the papers and, like, conceals it. And, like, that's the realization. Like, that's the moment where you realize that Sam Rockwell is a lot better of a character than you're led to believe based on what you've seen from him throughout the entire film.
Well, also, him and Alfie Allen are gay.
Yeah.
And you could not be gay in Nazi Germany.
No.
And they're so blatantly gay in this movie without them ever saying it. I mean, Alfie Allen is, I think, arguably the most underrated actor out there, because this Theon Greyjoy got no credit and he was freaking impeccable in that role. And then he's great in this movie. He was great in John Wick. Like, Alfie Allen's a great actor. But you know, he does have the humanity. There's that's one of my favorite scenes. So I want to talk about kind of that whole sequence there, because I think it's actually a really powerful sequence that's worth mentioning a little bit more in detail. A lot of people when this movie came out felt that there was too much mentioning of Hitler's name. And honestly, as I've said his name so many times on this podcast, I get uncomfortable, and I hope people aren't getting uncomfortable. We're talking about two movies that actually have him as a character, so it's kind of hard not to. But in this scene, they play the Heil Hitler for a joke, and you say, oh man, I don't know if that's the kind of joke I'm into. You have Stephen Merchant and four other men come in. They say it to everybody. They make Jojo Rabbit say it to everybody. Then Alfie Allen and Sam Rockwell come in. Now they have to say it to everybody again. So now we have heard it 12 times at least. No, it's 24 times, because it's five from the five men, then five times from Jojo Rabbit, then two more times from each of the five men, and it's five times from Alfie Allen and whatever. So it's like 24 times, whatever. It doesn't matter the math. And you're sitting there and you're like, okay, this is the joke, whatever. But when they go upstairs and Elsa pretends to be Inga and they say Heil Hitler to her, and now she has to say it back eight times, that is set up. That is absolutely incredible, because you see the pain on her face, how she's having to say this, knowing that she's hiding behind a wall because of all of these things, and doing that. It is so well done. I mean, that's the kind of stuff where sometimes you have to take the risk, and Waititi does it here, so you can have that payoff. Because what seems like it's trying to be a cheap joke is actually setting up. Remember when you were laughing earlier, potentially? You're not laughing now. Nope. No way you're laughing now. And it's been less than 5 minutes of film time. And the other part of this, you feel like Elsa is very on her shit. She comes out, she's cleaned up, she had just taken the bath, everything's great. She's pretending to be Inga. The picture kind of looked like her anyway, whatever. Where are your papers? Find the papers, give them over. And he asks the birth date, and she says May 1st. And he's like, well, you got it. And you're like, okay, whew, she is on her stuff. Good job, whatever. But when she goes in that room and she says it was the 7th, they're going to be coming back. It was her birthday was the 7th. The reveals there. You already said it. Sam Rockwell's humanity. Also, Sam Rockwell knows that Scarlett Johansson, I don't think at that point they had known she was killed, but they know that that's why the Gestapo were there, is to take her out. Yeah, because she hadn't been killed yet, because the Gestapo were just coming to search around.
Yeah.
He knows what's going to happen. And he likes her. He does have a relationship with her that is a good relationship, even though the first time they see each other, she kicks him in the nuts. Like, that is, they do have a strong relationship. And so for him to say, bingo, you nailed it. You know who you are. And then for us to realize she's not as on this as we thought she was. And Sam Rockwell is not the evil man we thought he was. And it adds that tension of, oh God, what are these people going to do now? Are they coming back? Is there a ticking clock? What is going to happen? And honestly, it unfolds beautifully from there on. But, you know, we'll talk. I mean, Sam Rockwell might be the king of playing absolutely horrible people who are very redemptive. Because, you know, in Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, I mean, there was like a riot when he won the Oscar. Because how could you win the Oscar for playing a racist? And it's like, think about the depth and levels to that character, people. Like, there's so much going on there. And at the end of this movie, he has one of the best turns. I mean, it's just it's beautiful.
The moment when the American soldiers are coming in, they're getting together all of the Nazis, and Sam Rockwell pushes Jojo away and says, "Get away from me, Jew."
Takes off his member. He also takes off the uniform. Jojo is wearing the SS jacket.
Yeah, it's just it's so powerful, and. As much as the performance by this kid, whose name I have forgotten right now.
It is Roman Griffin Davis.
Yeah, Roman Griffin Davis is phenomenal in this film. And again, so was Thomas McKenzie. it's the adult performances in this film though that really elevate it. Mm-hmm. It's just phenomenal, and it's that balance between comedy and drama that a seasoned actor like someone like Scarlett Johansson and Taika Waititi and Sam Rockwell have that makes this movie so powerful.
Well, and I think of it as like, it reminds me a lot of Moonrise Kingdom. Obviously, Moonrise mm-hmm. Kingdom is a lot less serious and a lot less dramatic because it's not set against World War II. But the kids in that movie are great.
Yeah.
But it's Bill Murray and Francis McDormand and Bruce Willis and Edward Norton who mm-hmm. elevate that movie to another level. It's yeah. the depression you feel, and they sleep in different beds. They have nothing in common. She's cheating on him with Bruce Willis. The adults have no joy left in their life. And so the adults in this movie who are such caricatures of the different people that you would meet during this era, mm-hmm. they do such a great job. I mean, it is such a strong cast. I mean, Scarlett Johansson was nominated for 2 Oscars that year. She was nominated for this, yeah. and she was nominated for lead for Marriage Story. I mean, she's nominated for both. It's great. Rockwell was coming off 2 years earlier, winning his Oscar for 3 Billboards. Waititi mm-hmm. obviously was still coming into his own there, but to take on the role and play Hitler himself and to play it in this buffoonish type way, it takes a really talented actor to be able to pull that off. And yeah, I mean, we talked about, because when we were doing the MCU movies, I was talking about how like Waititi's movies really weren't that good. Mm-hmm. You know, the Thor movies are whatever. And watching this back, I'm like, nah, man, he could butcher every other movie he ever makes.
Yeah.
But he made Jojo Rabbit. Yeah. Like, he made Jojo Rabbit. And if he's a one-hit wonder, then so – I know he did What We Do in the Shadows. I get it. But it's like, if this is really his thing, if this is his movie, this is the only time he gets the Oscar nomination for Best Picture, so be it, man. Like, just so be it.
Yeah. Yeah, he made a perfect film. And that's what it comes down to. One thing I do want to talk about before we wrap things up. The use of British music, post-World War II British music sung in German.
Yep.
Is
Heroes, so man.
Good. Oh, man. Oh, Heroes at the end of this is just, it's one of those, it's a sigh of relief moment. And it's just it's a very powerful moment that just resonates with you. I remember sitting there as this movie ended, and it's like, I am staying here for all of Heroes because A, the song's a banger, and yep. B, it just like it gives you that sense of relief as you watch Jojo and Elsa just dance, because that's what free people do.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the line again, man. It's the setup.
Yeah,
it is the setup of free people dance when, you know, whatever it was like people who are like under whatever, live, free people dance. Yeah, it's great. And I mean, for them to just, what do we do now when they walk? Is it dangerous out there? Very. And she slaps him in the face and he's like, yeah, I deserve that. And then it's, what do we do now? And they just start because they are free. They are free. They are free. They are free. And yeah, it's just, it's a great movie, man. This
I'm really glad we revisited it for this.
I am really too.
And Guy Ritchie made a movie that made us think of this as something to talk about this week.
Yeah, and you know what's funny is like there's your connection between the first episode in this series. Heroes is also the song in Godzilla because it's the Wallflowers version of Heroes instead of Jacob Dylan, baby. So I'm glad I rewatched Jojo Rabbit. This was a movie that I probably would have waited a really long time to rewatch. This is a movie that, like, I could see myself years into my life here, 10 years, 5 years, whatever it is from now, saying, you know what, maybe that is a top 100 movie when I'm a little bit more removed from it, because it is just powerful from start to finish. And unfortunately, man, I say it all the time, but like, unfortunately, some of these movies that are about, you know, World War II and stuff like that feel more and more relevant the more we like the further things go on. And, you know, obviously we have like the whole Middle East conflict going on right now. America is in like what, the equivalent of a civil war without picking up arms against each other. Like, everybody hates each other. You know, universities are like, I mean, they're just becoming like places to protest. Like, that's what it is. And when that's happening, it can feel like we're back in the 60s sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of vitriol in this country. There's a lot of vitriol in this world. And, you know, you watch a movie like Jojo Rabbit and you say to yourself, man, how did he make me laugh at some of this stuff and then make me cry and make me feel so many of these things. So that's it, man. That's it. Yeah. That's all I got. I'm exhausted from it.
Yeah. It's some heavy subject matter. Like, despite the fact that these are both comedies, they're dealing with heavy subject matter. Subject matter that we tend to like. I mean, we've talked about a lot of World War II movies on the podcast so far.
Yeah, we have. World War II and Vietnam movies, man. There's something about it.
Movies. Man, crazy. Yeah. People have things to say about massive world events, but...
Yeah. Well, next week we're going to be doing Sicario and the Nice Guys because The Fall Guy comes out. So we're taking an Emily Blunt movie and we're taking a Ryan Gosling movie. Sicario and the Nice Guys. I'm actually really excited for that
one. I'm really excited for those
movies in a while. So I'm really pumped for that one. Then we do Dawn of the Planet of the Apes in Westworld. And then we take a week off because I'm not here. So only two more episodes before I take my week off. If you want to become a patron, patreon.com/thespecialist. Last week we did Shrek 2. We do $5 Tuesdays every week. So if you're a $5 patron or up, you get one movie podcast every single week. Tomorrow's one is Some Like It Hot, 1959 Billy Wilder movie. That's going to be a good one. And then the week after we do The Spy Who Shagged Me, the second in the Austin Powers trilogy. And then on May 7th, because we have no choice, we're doing The Phantom Menace. We're doing The Phantom Menace. So if you want to become a patron, patreon.com/thespecialist. If you're a movie fan listening to us and you're also into Survivor and some of the other stuff we do, Patreon is the best way to get more content from us. We have a lot of fun over there and we have a lot of people who are new, a lot of new patrons, a lot of people who are coming in and really starting to like, I don't want to say drink our Kool-Aid because we're not trying to Jonestown it, but you know, they're starting to dive in and it's been a lot of fun. So thank you so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed this podcast. Like the video, subscribe to the channel, and we'll see you next week when we talk about The Nice Guys and Sicario. Bye everyone.